This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is warning the coronavirus pandemic is out of control, calling it the number one global security threat in the world today. During a news briefing with reporters, he called for global solidarity in making a future vaccine affordable and available to all. He makes the statement amid the growing coronavirus deaths and infections. More than 939,000 people have died worldwide from COVID-19, while the number of global infections is less than a quarter million shy of reaching a new milestone of 30 million. Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump is predicting a coronavirus vaccine could be ready in the coming weeks, something that contradicts the government's top health experts. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
President Trump, who's been promising warp speed in vaccine production, now says
we're on track to deliver and distribute the vaccine in a very, very safe and effective manner. We think we can start sometime in October.
That contradicts most medical experts and undermines Dr. Robert Redfield, who heads the Federal Centers for Disease Control, who said a vaccine can't be available on a widespread basis until next spring or summer.
I believe he was confused. I'm just telling you, we're ready to go.
President Trump also contradicted Dr. Redfield about the effectiveness of wearing a face mask. Democrat Joe Biden weighed in.
I trust scientists, but I don't trust Donald Trump.
Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Hurricane Sally has killed at least one person, swamped homes, and forced the rescue of hundreds. Storm crawled ashore near the Florida-Alabama line on Wednesday with 105 mile-per-hour winds and rain that measured in feet, not inches. One death has been reported. More at VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. Wildfire crews in the U.S. state of California and across the West admit to being exhausted as they have to respond to an incredible number of fires this season. We get more from AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
California Governor Gavin Newsom puts it bluntly. This has been the worst fire season ever.
3.4 million acres, close to 8,000 fires.
Crews are walking off one fire just to be called in to battle a new blaze. Newsom says drought, climate change, and pests, not poor forest management, are to blame.
We are doing the kind of prescribed burns, doing the kind of thinning that has an environmental construct.
Human, mechanical, and financial resources are taxed to the breaking point at the state and federal level. Firefighters from as far away as Israel are involved in the fight. Government spending on fighting wildfires has more than tripled since the 1990s to an average of $1.8 billion each year. I'm Tim McGuire.
U.S. Undersecretary of State Keith Krotz is scheduled to meet Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen and other senior officials once he settles in after his arrival there. His visit follows a high-profile visit in August of U.S. Health Secretary Alex Azar, who was the highest-level U.S. cabinet official to visit since a break in formal ties between the U.S. and Taiwan and the Taiwan government in 1979 when the U.S. accepted the One China policy with Beijing as its government. However, the U.S. has maintained unofficial ties with Taiwan since the official diplomatic break and the island's most important ally and provider of defense equipment. Krotz is expected to participate in an economic dialogue with the Taiwanese government. He will attend a memorial service for the former president who led the island's transition to democracy, who died in July. Yoshihide Suga is officially Japan's new prime minister after being voted in by the country's parliament Wednesday. He appointed a cabinet and retained many of those who worked with his predecessor, Shinzo Abe. Suga, who was considered Abe's right-hand man, has pledged to pursue many of Abe's programs and his economic strategy. Suga also said during a news conference on Wednesday that he would implement policies to beef up Tokyo's alliance with the United States. This is while also hoping to establish stable relationships with both China and Russia. Again, Yoshihide Suga is officially Japan's new prime minister after being voted in by the country's parliament on Wednesday. More at VOAnews.com via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A court in Paris has sentenced former World Athletic Director Lamine Diaw to 4 years in prison.
The judgment has 87-year-old Senegalese Lamine Diaw, ex-World Athletics, or IAAF chief, serving 2 years in jail with an additional two-year suspended sentence.
Analysts say Ethiopia-Eritrea peace deal has little to show. Experts say ECOWAS's deadline for Mali's military leaders is unrealistic. Protests in Nigeria over electricity and fuel prices increase amid coronavirus pandemic. And lawyers for Rwanda's Paul Rusesabagina are in court today to ask for his conditional release.
I requested that any direct, it is for the appreciation of the court to grant what we have requested or to defend accordingly.
And South African doctors see a boom in plastic surgery during COVID-19 pandemic. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Court in Paris has sentenced former World Athletic chief Lamine Diaw to 4 years in prison on charges of corruption, money laundering, and abuse of confidence. The charges stem from a Russian doping scandal and for accepting Russian money to finance the 2012 campaign of Senegalese President Macky Sall. Lisa Bryan reports from Paris.
The judgment has 87-year-old Senegalese Lamine Diaw, ex-World Athletics, or IAAF chief, serving 2 years in jail with an additional two-year suspended sentence. The court also fined him nearly $600,000, the maximum under French law.
Cela est profondément injuste. Nous trouvons que
Diaw's lawyers say they will appeal what they describe as a profoundly unfair verdict. Either way, Diaw appears unlikely to go to jail. The presiding judge predicted a conditional release given his age. Diaw's Dakar-based son, Papa Massata Diaw, got a tougher sentence in absentia, 5 years in prison, along with a nearly $1.2 million fine. The younger Diaw is accused of overseeing a vast network of corruption as a former IAAF marketing advisor.
Et sur ces accusations, je peux dire qu'aujourd'hui, au moment où je vous parle,
Papa Massata Diaw refused to attend the Paris trial. Speaking to reporters in Dakar earlier this week, he insisted he was innocent. In addition, an investigation against him is underway in Senegal. During the Paris trial, the senior Diaw also denied corruption. He admitted to slowing the handling of Russian doping allegations, but said it was to snag lucrative Russian sponsorship deals that would help shore up the organization's finances. Furthermore, the senior Diaw denied charges of taking Russian funds to finance the successful 2012 election campaign of Senegalese President Macky Sall. Trial observers say Diaw's testimony was often confusing. One of Diaw's lawyers urged leniency, saying it was important he die in dignity in his native land. Prosecutors argued Diaw's behavior deeply tarnished the IAAF. A once powerful figure in the sports world, Diaw headed the IAAF for 16 years before stepping down in 2015. Olympic gold medalist Sebastian Coe took over as head of the organization, which has been renamed World Athletics. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
In Rwanda, lawyers for Paul Rusesabagina, the man depicted in the Hollywood movie about Rwanda's 1994 genocide, are in court today to ask for his conditional release. He was charged on Monday this week with 13 counts, including terrorism, complicity in murder, and forming or joining an irregular armed group. Prosecutors say he may face 25 years in jail if convicted. David Urugasa is one of Rusesabagina's lawyers.
My expectation is based on what I have requested to the court.
What did you request of the court?
My dear, it's not actually advisable to talk the professional secrets of what we have done. It was an open hearing, which whoever who was there, they have recorded, but we are not allowed to repeat what we have said in the court as per the professional secrets.
So your client faces some serious charges. What are your concerns in terms of whether he can get a fair trial?
Of course, I'm expecting to get a fair trial. I can't know more than what I'm expecting unless it happens. But as for now, I'm still expecting.
The charges against him are serious, according to the government. Has he entered any plea?
He's not charged up to now. He's under suspicious, but he's not charged.
Some people are suggesting whether there should be international observation of any trial.
What I can tell you is the trial is in public. Whoever wants can come, as it was. Everybody was back. Whoever wants to come, they were there. So I don't mean what you mean by international, because the trial is supposed to be in public. And it was in public, by the way.
When we talked the last time, I asked whether you know how the government got to arrest him.
I think that one, we haven't yet reached at that point. But I heard he has talked to the Washington Post. Maybe we may hear about it. Washington Post yesterday, he has told them everything. I think you can get it from there.
Were you present when he talked to the Washington Post?
That's what I told you, that I heard he has talked to the Washington Post. And I heard that he has talked about those things. I think it's better to link with those ones so that you can get that information.
So what I was asking, were you present? Were you there?
That's the only answer which I can give you as per now, my dear.
So this is about whether he should get a bill, is that right?
My expectation is based on my request to them. That's what I'm saying. So I'm expecting on half request.
Did you ask the court to grant bail?
I told you that what I have requested to the court, it is what I'm expecting. And the hearing was in the public. Of course, I can't miss to ask for the provisional release. That was my major request.
Okay, you want a provisional release?
Yes.
Do you think that the court might grant provisional release?
I requested that. Then the rest, it is for the appreciation of the court to grant what we have requested or to defend accordingly. With that one, I can't know whether, but what I'm trusting with, it is what I've requested. And my request was based on the legal provision.
Is he aware of the international interest in his case?
Really, we haven't yet discussed about that.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
David Rugaza is one of the lawyers for Paul Rusesabagina of Rwanda. You are speaking with us from the capital, Kigali. Analysts say a peace deal reached between Eritrea and Ethiopia in July 2018 has brought few tangible benefits, with trade routes still blocked and tension on the borders still rife. They note that regional strongmen in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region, which borders Ethiopia, have yet to forge a lasting peace deal with the leadership in Asmara. The border has yet to be demarcated, and heavily armed soldiers still man disputed areas. Simon Monks reports from Addis Ababa.
Initial signs after the peace deal between Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and Eritrean President Isaias Afwerki were positive, in that telephone connections were re-established, flights between Addis Ababa and Asmara resumed, and goods flowed over the border. Experts, however, say huge barriers still remain in order to achieve a lasting peace and normalized relations. Many Eritreans began fleeing their homes to seek refuge in Ethiopia as a result of border crossing openings, meaning trade routes were soon closed again. Analysts say that deep-rooted historical tension between Eritrea and the regional powers in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region has led to a situation where trade flows are now non-existent and many areas remain heavily militarized. Salam Tadesa Demisi, a research officer at the South Africa-based Institute for Security Studies, said via a messaging app that the fruits of the peace deal were still pending, in part due to the Ethiopian government's inability to suppress long-held suspicion about its northern neighbor in the Tigray region. From 1998 until 2000, Eritrea and Ethiopia fought a border war that left an estimated 80,000 people dead before a prolonged stalemate took hold over the next two decades.
We expect more, actually a lot more, out of this peace deal. And if we see it time-wise, it's been over 2 years. So by now, we should have seen a lot of fruits of the peace deal. But what's happening on the ground is actually the contrary.
Salam said that interaction among communities on both sides of the border remains very limited. One point of contention within Ethiopia is where the federal soldiers remain stationed on the border with Eritrea. In the immediate aftermath of the deal, four border posts opened, allowing trade to resume. They soon closed again, however, after officials in Ethiopia's Tigray region raised concerns. There has also been no progress on demarcating disputed border areas, particularly around the town of Badme, which the Eritrea-Ethiopia Boundary Commission established to resolve the border issue, decided in 2002 should belong to Eritrea.
From the Eritrean side, that rule that whoever goes out of their country will be shot down still applies from the Eritrean side. And from the Tigrayan side, from the Tigray border side, it's still militarized.
Neither government commented on the state of the peace deal. Martin Plaut, a senior research fellow at the University of London, said it appeared extremely difficult to gain much traction on the peace deal without new leadership taking power in the Tigray region, which ruled the country for about three decades and has been ostracized by the federal government in Addis Ababa. The region is at loggerheads with the federal government and last week held an election, despite the government deeming it illegal.
The relationship between the Tigrayans and the Eritreans and between the leadership between them is permanently bad. There's no way that can improve unless a new party came to power in Tigray. I mean, the problems go back to the 1970s. They are very deep, they are very bitter, they are very personal, and they are impossible to mend, in my view.
Plaut added that one of the great drivers of the peace deal was a large untapped deposit of the compound potash, which contains potassium, that straddles the border and is currently being developed by Danakali, an Australian mining company.
It is a massive, massive reserve which could provide potash for global markets for maybe 100, even 200 years. That is driving a lot of this, and people never talk about it.
The Ethiopian and Eritrean leaders last met in July in Eritrea in a visit where Ethiopia's Abiy attended the graduation of a batch of national service trainees, a program that has long been criticized due to its forced conscription. Simon Marks for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, September 17. Leaders of West African states and Mali's military coup failed to agree on a transfer to civilian rule in talks on Tuesday, raising concerns about the political standoff and regional security in that country. Security experts in Ghana, where the talks took place, say the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, needs to help Mali return to normalcy, as it is in a dire situation. Stacey Nant reports from Accra.
Ghana's president and ECOWAS chairman, Nana Akufo-Addo, told reporters after the meeting they have not reached any agreement with the military junta. The regional bloc wanted the military leaders to immediately hand over power to a civilian government. The bloc had imposed economic sanctions after the coup and given a Tuesday deadline for the junta to appoint a new president. There are fears the coup could undermine the fight in Mali and the Sahel region against Islamist militants with links to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State. Speaking before the talks began, Akufo-Addo said the situation requires Mali to resolve its political crisis immediately.
The terrorists are taking advantage of the situation in Mali to flex their muscles even more. Today is supposed to be the day when the military junta in Mali is to put in place a government which should respond to the criteria we set out at our last summit of 28th August 2020. That has not been.
David Agbe, executive director of the Ghana Institute of Governance and Security, said many factors at play in Mali need to be considered, including ethnic tensions, poverty, and the influence of France in the country. He said the deadline ECOWAS had given the junta would not work.
We are just jumping the gun, preaching that the country needs to return to democratic system of governance. That the internal processes, domestic issues need to be understood by the ECOWAS. They need to deal with the domestic issues and look at the significance of the citizens.
He said in these circumstances, citizens generally do not respect civilian rule. He said better outcomes could be achieved by helping the military bring back stability and then hand over power to civilians while building up democratic structures. If this situation is not handled sensitively, Agbe said there will be dire consequences for the stability of the Sahel region. Vladimir Antri Dunso, the Dean of Academic Affairs at the Ghana Armed Forces Command and Staff College, shared similar sentiments. Antri Dunso said he wants to see a more mature approach to help Mali transition to democracy and for ECOWAS to play a key role with mediation.
We need to have a transition to that normalcy, but to stampede the junta, to hand over quickly. The junta has not gotten a charter. They wanted an 18-month transition. Fine. I'm not saying that is best. But we needed to help to bring about a kind of understanding between the opposition and the junta.
ECOWAS leaders said they would be willing to allow a transitional government to stand for 18 months, longer than the original year it asked for. They also said they will fully accompany Mali towards the restoration of constitutional order and lift sanctions once the country has a president and prime minister in place for the transitional period. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
Nigerians are protesting a hike in electricity and fuel costs in the middle of the economic hardships from the COVID-19 pandemic. But authorities maintain the new rates are in the best interest of Nigerians. Timothy Obiesu reports from Abuja.
Angry protesters this month marched the gates of Nigeria's Electricity Regulatory Commission in Abuja. The protesters are demanding an immediate reversal of a government increase in electricity and fuel costs. Authorities nearly doubled the cost of power per kilowatt and removed a fuel subsidy, causing a jump in the price of gasoline. Sydney Usman is the Abuja head of Revolution Now, the group that led the protests.
It is anti-human, it is undemocratic, it is anti-people, and it's only aimed at subjecting the Nigerian people to more severe hardship. Not at this point in time, where we're just recovering from the pandemic, where livelihoods are lost, jobs are lost, businesses are grounded. How do you survive?
Millions of Nigerian businesses and shops rely on energy from electricity or petrol to operate. The COVID-19 pandemic's impact on the economy has already hurt many traders. Amina Aminu runs a bottled water company in Kwali on the outskirts of Abuja. She says the tariff increase will only add to production costs and further squeeze her profits.
All the capital we inject, it will go back to diesel and petrol. So there's not any profit because normally we have to transport the pure water. The bottled water is transportation. So we use diesel, we use petrol. And we use petrol and diesel to power our generator to produce.
Many Nigerians accuse authorities of being insensitive to the economic hardships caused by the coronavirus. But officials argue the rise in power and fuel costs will help ensure more reliable electricity and fuel supplies in Nigeria, despite market fluctuations. Otion Omonfoman is an energy consultant with the Etio Group, a Nigerian energy conglomerate. He says the pandemic's impact on tax revenue has forced the higher cost for power and petrol, also known as premium motor spirit, PMS.
Crude oil prices, our main earner, has been quite low. So the Nigerian government is simply struggling for revenues to balance its budget and therefore cannot afford subsidies on PMS. So it's a step in the right direction, in my view. It's unfortunately a necessary pain that we have to take.
Nigeria has spent around $22 billion in the last decade on fuel subsidies. Power authorities also generate electricity at a much higher cost than what is passed to consumers. But protesters say with the ongoing pandemic, they will not back down in their demand for a return to the prior level of government support. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Doctors in South Africa, the continent's coronavirus epicenter, expected to be busy as the virus ravaged its way across the Rainbow Nation. But one type of doctor is seeing an unexpected boom in demand. Plastic surgeons who say that the combination of lockdown, imposed isolation, and South Africa's world-class medical technology is causing a rush of people who are quietly changing their appearance. VOA's Anita Powell reports. From Johannesburg.
Dr. Sadia Lahir is very busy right now.
as the globe battles a pandemic. But the South African physician is not an infectious disease specialist. She's a plastic surgeon, and her days in this Johannesburg hospital are filled to overflowing with nips, tucks, and new breasts. Aesthetic surgeons in Johannesburg say they're seeing the same trend as their counterparts in the U.S., Japan, and elsewhere, a surge in demand for cosmetic procedures.
There's definitely been a flood of people coming through, and again, that's mostly because a lot of people are still at home. They also, you know, very aware. I think when something like a pandemic hits you, you kind of realize that we're all here on limited time and you want to make the most of everything. And if that means feeling better about yourself, then why not?
At her hospital in southern Johannesburg, patients are carefully monitored for any signs of coronavirus. They receive COVID tests before the procedure and are kept in separate wards from ill patients. Patient Alicia DeLong says she thought long and hard before going under the knife for a breast enlargement. She says she's happy with the results and was comfortable with her doctor's safety precautions. Her procedure was done at a fertility clinic, as her doctor feels it best to avoid hospitals.
It's something that I've really wanted to do for a very long time. And when the time came, I just thought I'd go ahead and do it, regardless of the time we're living in. We don't know how long it's going to last. We don't know when it's going to end.
Her procedure cost about $2,600. In the U.S., the average cost of that surgery is just under $4,000, according to the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. Dr. LaHare says she knows that her continent often gets attention for other health crises, but she notes South Africa's medical offerings are varied and world-class.
We still very much keep in touch with the latest and greatest of technologies and techniques. There's a lot of expertise out here. There's a lot to see and a lot to learn. And we've always been involved as a medical fraternity in all of that. So I think there's a lot that we can provide and contribute to. And I'd love everybody to come out and experience that with us as well.
And who knows what you'll leave with, she says. Maybe a new and improved you. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Thursday, September 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 2230 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
VOA's Our Voices television program is about more than just sitting and talking about women's issues. It's about listening to them and bringing their opinions to the table and making sure that their voices are heard. Because our lived experiences, our stories, and our voices will help shape the next generation.
Check your local TV listings and join the conversation each week with Our Voices on VOA.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to Ndumbulu and Makossa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.